Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's back. The new year's barely started, and Republicans want to pull up health care reform and whoop it some more. Dr. Atul Gawande says health care is going to keep coming back until we get it right. He'll have no vote in the House next week, but he has a lot to say about how we Americans organize and practice medicine. He's probably got a checklist. This hour on Point, surgeon, writer, influencer, Atul Gawande on getting American health care right. You can join the conversation. What's your question on cost control, end-of-life decisions, the death panel charge, rationing, the individual mandate? What do you want to know from a doctor who's right in the middle of it all, right on the front lines? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Atul Gawande joins me now in the studio, renowned surgeon, writer, and medical thinker. He's a surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health, a staff writer for The New Yorker, and one of the nation's most influential voices on health care and reform. His latest book, out today in paperback, is The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. Atul Gawande, Dr. Gawande, great to have you back with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So here comes healthcare again. I mean, I guess it's not going to go away, and it won't go away as a public issue until we sort of really get on top of it. But the hook we've gotten right in front of us is Republicans saying they're going to put it up for a vote in the House of Representatives, where they now have a majority again, next Wednesday, probably, repeal of the entire Obama healthcare reform package that we debated and debated and debated. I don't know. If you were sitting there, how would you vote on this thing?
I'd vote against. I mean, a repeal would be return to stalemate. And the real danger we have is, from what I understand, I'm certainly not a political analyst, but from what I understand, that if the even if it passes, the repeal doesn't have the votes to
It won't make it
through
the Senate, but they say if we don't do it, that we will come back salami style and slice and slice and slice anything we can off this thing.
And there are many ways to stalemate progress on health care.
So if you're looking at the whole package of what finally went through last year, on balance, does it look good to you?
Yes. It is a remarkable thing to have passed a program that can get 34 million people insurance who didn't have it, and that pushes us down the road to taking seriously the needs of cost and quality that our healthcare system's not delivering on.
Is there anything you would change if you were on one of these now Republican-chaired committees in Congress that are going to, take out the stick and whack at this some more?
Of course, but let's go back in time to Medicare. When Medicare passed, we remember it now as this wonderful program that passed and slid smoothly into
You're
practice.
You're talking way back in the 60s, LBJ,
way back 1965.
President Johnson. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And in the first year after Medicare passed, what really happened was a movement that looks not unlike this, a powerful effort to try to stop Medicare, both by doctors who threatened to boycott patients who came in with their Medicare cards.
Is
and
that
refused
right?
To treat
it wasn't
them.
Hallelujah, here it is.
That's right.
It was no thank you.
The 10,000 physicians in Ohio's State Medical Association voted that they would not treat elderly patients carrying Medicare cards.
Wow.
And then you had a second repeal and reject movement in the South, where hospitals that accepted Medicare patients would have to integrate, that white hospitals would have to accept black patients, that black and white patients might even be in the same rooms together, caused such social outrage that 50% of hospitals in the South said they would refuse Medicare patients.
This is in the first year or so.
This is in the first weeks.
It kicked in, and Americans came to accept it as the way things are.
And it kicked in because of presidential leadership, and it was a fight. The president decided to battle on the segregation of the hospitals. He sent over 1,000 inspectors into southern hospitals. There were, people in the South were saying, "We don't want this,"
mm-hmm.
and and he sent inspectors to the hospitals. He made them
to
remove,
make sure they were doing it.
They were integrating and make sure that he even went so far as removing the labels, having the inspectors ensure that labels were removed on blood so people couldn't tell whether they were getting white blood or black blood.
What's the lesson for President Barack Obama and his health care reform package now?
Well, part of the lesson is interesting because Johnson was not all about attack, attack, attack. He also compromised with the American Medical Association and found ways to bring the doctors on board. And there were a series about a 9 months later, a series of 30 improving amendments, as they called them, that passed in order to and some of them were genuine improvements in the Medicare plan. So, you know, I think that the lesson for the administration is that implementation, and I think they know this, implementation is as serious and as rough and tumble as passage. Making insurance work for a program to roll out through 50 states means being able to win people over state by state and sometimes fight battles and directly confront and other times conciliate and compromise. And I think that experience is what we're about to go through in the next year, choosing some battles and accepting some compromise.
A year and more. I mean, this is a long rollout for the healthcare reform package. It's going to take several years. Is that vulnerability?
It is vulnerability. Medicare rolled out over a period of about 9 to 12 months when people then got their Medicare cards. By contrast, this program really starts up and going, providing insurance to people, getting underway in 2014, mainly because what also needs to happen in a dramatic way that didn't have to happen in the 1960s is that the quality, the safety, and our and the cost of healthcare are central issues that people in healthcare have gotten the message, have started to make some remarkable changes on the ground. A story that really is missed outside of Washington, but a lot of that change effort has to happen.
But because this package says, I mean, a lot of things aren't nailed down yet. A lot of the cost savings here, how that's going to be done, aren't entirely clear here. This is being farmed out in a way by design in this healthcare reform package to people all over the country to experiment in pilot programs and find better ways of doing things.
Yeah, one of the oddities of thinking about healthcare reform is that on the one hand, we have had off-the-shelf solutions for providing insurance to people that have been there for 30 to 50 years. Mm-hmm. We have been debating, do we want the option on the shelf that is a public option, you know, cover everybody through Medicare for all? Do we want a private option, make everybody receive private insurance coverage? Or do we want a mix? And we voted for the mix one way or the other. There's lots of still sturm and drang about whether that's the right decision, but there was the choice. We do not have on the shelf ways that we've recognized to effectively ensure across the country that we are lowering costs without harming quality of care, in fact, improving quality of care. But we also know that there are local communities all over that are lower cost than other communities while generating better quality of care. And so what we're having is a series of experiments, exactly as you described.
By design, in this legislation, if it's not repealed or hacked away.
That's right. Right here in Boston, there is at the Mass General Hospital funded some of the reform efforts have funded a program that is expanding a program that now is currently lowering healthcare costs for the 10% most expensive elderly patients enrolled at the Mass General Hospital, and they're doing it primarily by ensuring that these patients have better primary care, that that they aren't being just, you know, 4 o'clock you find that you're sick and with a cough and call up the primary care doctor's office and you get the coverage, no one knows you, they're sending you to the emergency room where no one knows you, and instead coordinating care for very complex people and finding that by improving their care, they're making them less likely to need the hospital, need the emergency room, and be able to handle the vicissitudes of complex illness.
This can sound kind of like a hodgepodge to have a lot of people experimenting on ways to do things in a more cost-effective way, but you look back a century and more to the Department of Agriculture and how they got American agriculture up on the rails and the most productive in the world through very similar means.
Yeah, one of the interesting perspectives to me is that there was, at the turn of the last century, a problem with the cost of food, much as we have the problem with the cost of healthcare today. 40% of family budgets went to paying for food.
Wow.
50% of the country was employed on farms to provide the food that mm-hmm. the country needed. And this was such a crisis around the world. No one knew how to make food less expensive. The communist experiment was around partly around the idea that scientific farming and collective farming would solve this problem. Instead, it killed millions. The American experiment was that a combination of things, government stepping in, not to run farms, but to do everything from providing data, like creating the National Weather Service, providing crop reports, to having extension agents who...
To spread best practices.
Spread best practices, how to farm corn well, how to farm cotton well.
But on medicine, we're far from the international forefront at this point.
We are.
Will this model work?
Well, I mean, we're not... So, yes, there are in America some of the best innovations in how to design the delivery of healthcare in the world, along with a vast mediocre delivery system and some places that are
really... Giant cost and nowhere near the top of the longevity charts.
That's right. But we have these pockets of extraordinary innovation mm-hmm. where there are two pieces of knowledge that people are starting to make work. One is how to pay doctors differently so they are... being rewarded for quality and not just the quantity of operations and x-rays and so mm-hmm. on that we do. Mm-hmm. And second of all, how to deliver that, not just financing, but then how to, at the front line, make an operation go really well. Stuff like my research team does, where we devise a checklist that could cut the death rate for surgery 50% and lower its cost.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American healthcare with Dr. Atul Gawande as Republicans prepare to try to repeal American healthcare reform. A vote's now slated for next week. It is almost certain to pass with the Republican majority in the House, not the Senate. So there will be another way, but they're saying we're going to whack away at it until we make big change. Atul Gawande has been writing about American healthcare, its delivery, the whole system and process from the ground up. His latest book, just out in paperback today, is The Checklist Manifesto, and we'll talk about that. I just wanted to ask you, people are obviously and understandably concerned about healthcare in all its manifestations. But when you look at it was such a big issue in politics last year. It was maybe pivotal in the election, midterm election outcomes. What do you see as the heart of the pushback against the reform that we saw? Do you see something very legitimate there? Do you see the healthcare industry in there somewhere? A certain political view? What do you see at the heart of the very large resistance that showed itself in Republican electoral gains in many ways?
At the heart of it, to me, is complexity. The ability to, here we've come at the end of this last century, and scientifically, we have discovered over 13,000 different diagnoses that the human body has, different ways the human body can fail. Mm-hmm. And for that, we've generated, especially during the last couple of decades, a total of now more than 6,000 drugs and more than 4,000 medical and surgical procedures. And mm-hmm. we're trying to have a system that delivers them consistently to people in every town in the country. We want every person to have optimal availability of those services. And the complexity of making those things work well, deliver it properly, and in a way that does not waste resources and that proves affordable is something that people have real doubts in the ability of our society to make possible. That is, we are currently not able to do it, and the commitment to making sure that we provide access to all of that to everybody is something that at a core level, people have doubts and mistrust about, whether it's trusting that the government can pull it off, trust that insurance companies and the free market will pull it off, or a combination of the two.
Is the resistance then to this package of reform, do you see it as based on the particular elements of the reform, or is it just, I don't trust that this can be done, and so I want to be sure I've got mine, Jack?
There is an I think you hit it on the nail, that there is a sense that this is so complex, I don't believe that any – there is not a consensus or a majority of Americans who would say that any given solution – once you get into the details, it is every solution ends up being a 2,000-plus page package. And being able to ensure that we have coverage for everybody and ensure that we are making progress towards understanding how to control costs and not harm people's quality is such a daunting task to people that people lose hope. And that's where especially in an environment where we're at 10% unemployment, the economy's failing. Let me give you a story that helps bring this home. Mm-hmm. I went to our parent-teacher conference for my kid's school. Mm-hmm. We're in a prosperous suburb here in Newton, and we have a new superintendent, and I ran into him, and he's known for being really interested in school reforms. And I went to him. I said, what are you working on that you think you might do here in the Newton schools? Mm-hmm. And he said, you know what I'm spending all my time working on? Healthcare.
Not teaching kids, but getting coverage for the teachers.
That's right. Proposition 2.5 in Massachusetts
limiting property taxes.
Mm-hmm. And he said so his revenues have not gone up for teaching, but 9%
increase faced all in many many communities around the country.
Mm-hmm. But his health care costs for his teachers went up 9%, and so his choices are. I was already complaining at our parent-teacher conference about my children's math program having 30 students to one teacher. And here was the superintendent saying, my choices are that we cut healthcare for my teachers. Our safety valve in America is if you allow there to be uninsurance, then heck, we could even reach a point where you have uninsured teachers. And or you have you have the teachers you need for that classroom.
So here's healthcare horning in on the education of your child and many others. It just goes after everything if you don't get a handle on it.
And to really close the loop, I ran into then one of the teachers who I'd operated on. She had a lymphoma. Mm-hmm. She's one of the most expensive patients for his school system, for my school system. Mm-hmm. And what I realized is that I'm part of bankrupting our healthcare system.
So because of what you're charging?
Because of what I'm charging, what we do when we take care of a lymphoma, and what's needed to save her life. Now, I do not believe for a minute that saving her life means that the future of my child is doomed. But unless we are willing to be innovative and understanding that that these are all connected. Now, our politics have boiled it down to people saying, grow up, you can't have them both. You got to choose the teacher or your kid. Mister, or
but that choice scarcely works in the long run if a dead teacher doesn't teach.
I think that the lessons of what we accomplished in an industry like with food or in other areas, we have higher quality food now than we did a century ago. We are doing it at far lower cost, and we freed up a whole society of people to work and do other kinds of work. And what we see are innovations in healthcare that are able to do that now as well.
So what about the fork in the road that is hypothetically right in front of us here? If healthcare reform rolls forward as laid out in the legislation passed last year, do you see this country's healthcare on a track to a sustainable future, a good future? On the other hand, if not repealed, then substantially, tangled up and doesn't roll forward, what does that promise for us?
There is no track forward that I can see going backward and stopping healthcare reform and putting us back in the stalemate.
Something will happen if that happens. I mean, some reality would emerge from that. What?
It will be, again, a stalemate. There will be no forward progress on trying anything new in healthcare.
What does stalemate mean, though? Is that sustainable? Stalemate sounds sustainable, but I don't think you are suggesting that.
Stalemate is by 2019, the cost of people's healthcare insurance will be roughly double what it is for a family policy. It means that the state budgets that currently are just trying to cover what we have for Medicaid will have to double. It means that the federal debt will explode even more. Now, there isn't what we have in healthcare reform is the way forward of saying it's no longer business as usual. Mm-hmm. We are going to have everybody in under the tent. Mm-hmm. We're going to have coverage.
With the individual mandate.
With an individual mandate, mm-hmm. with a vote that what we want is a private insurance system. And in order to have that function, everybody would have to get it, mm-hmm. buy into insurance. Mm-hmm. And enormous pressure on that private insurance system to on the doctors and everybody on up the chain to make sure that for that teacher who has lymphoma, mm-hmm. that we actually learn to and do deliver better care for that patient with lower cost using ensuring she has fewer complications, that we don't do unnecessary testing.
You're saying the reform package ensures this, guarantees that that's the path we're on?
Absolutely does not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely does not. But it puts us on that path forward. Right now, what's going on is since the passage of reform, hospital systems and doctor's offices around the country have gotten a message that the current way of practicing cannot continue as it is.
And partly that's gone into effect already. I mean, health insurance companies have been told you can no longer keep 35, 40, 50% of a premium and not spend it on patients.
That's right. Or that you can't.
Under the new legislation, they've got to spend, 80% or something like that and not keep it for themselves.
Or your cost control department cannot focus on rescinding coverage for breast cancer patients or figuring out how to keep people out mm-hmm. because that's been the more effective way for them to spend their resources. Mm-hmm. Now it's forced them to start inventing and approaching a very interesting thing, which is how to rejigger their payments, both in Medicare, in the government insurance programs, and in the private insurance programs to reward physicians for higher quality results with lower costs. There's an asthma program I've written about mm-hmm. at the Children's Hospital where they implemented a checklist for asthma that lowered the likelihood a child that slashed the admissions for their asthma patients by 80%, enormously lowered the cost for mm-hmm. children with asthma. Mm-hmm. But guess what the number one revenue is for Children's Hospital Boston? Asthma admissions. And so to run this program would bankrupt themselves.
There's a built-in conflict of interest in letting this kind of progress happen.
That's right.
If it succeeds, their old financial model fails. What do they do?
And so since reform and the pressures that mm-hmm. have come into place to say that this system cannot be sustained, both Medicaid, the government program in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. as well as the private insurers, Blue Cross, worked out. They went to them and said, if you want us to provide great care at mm-hmm. lower cost, mm-hmm. we need to make this financially sustainable. And they devised a new approach for payment. It's complex. There are some fixed payments that go to them mm-hmm. for ensuring that asthma care is done properly. Mm-hmm. But it is innovation to begin to lower costs and change the whole way the system runs.
Dr. Atul Gawande is with us. His latest book is just out today in paperback, The Checklist Manifesto. Atul Gawande, let's go to our listeners. Traverse City, Michigan. Matt is on the line. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like someone to simply explain to me precisely what health insurance adds to health care. Perhaps I'm not seeing things properly, but to my observation, health insurance adds nothing but exorbitant cost and adds nothing to the actual, you know, practice of health care.
And Matt, do you mean private health insurance as opposed to what?
As opposed to, I suppose, Medicare for all, single-payer health insurance, something that was, of course, never in the discussion when the health care debate came up at the beginning of, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
National health care.
Matt, let us pick it up. I mean, there's the big skeptical question from the other side. You know, what does private health insurance do for us that single-payer national health insurance would not? Is there anything?
He's asking the absolutely the right question. And in many ways, I see this next period as a test of that matter. This is throwing the gauntlet down to private insurers. After this debate has happened, we're now in a phase where as they start providing insurance for the uninsured, they're being asked to reduce their expenses and to demonstrate that they can devise systems of payment for physicians and innovations that actually change the quality and cost of healthcare. Medicare is doing it at the exact same time. And the argument from the private insurers is that Medicare is too bureaucratic, too slow, too political, too stymied by partisanship in Washington to ever manage to deliver on it. Neither private insurance nor public insurance has managed to stem the tide of healthcare costs, the rise of triple the rate of our economic growth. Mm-hmm. And if there are innovations that are going to be successful, and I think the next 5 years are the test, they're either going to come out of how private insurance changes the incentives for healthcare or out of how public insurance does. And if we see private insurance has failed, the country will increasingly come to the conclusion that it sounds like this listener's come to, that a government insurance system is the only option. There are others, and I would count myself among them, who see some really absolutely fascinating innovative practices coming out of especially community health plans. There are plans like the Rocky Mountain Health Plan or Kaiser Health Plan or others that are dramatically changing healthcare, including paying doctors on salary, measuring their quality, tracking the service that patients receive and whether they are able to get same-day service when they're sick and have nighttime hours and weekend hours and really change the whole reward structure. But if they don't do it, then he's exactly right. What's the point of wasting that extra set of dollars that private insurance ends up sucking up?
Can you explain what's still driving these costs up so much? A friend of mine was just saying this morning, he opened up his bill for his health insurance in this new year, and it had gone up 12% over last year. 12%. Now, inflation last year was almost nothing. It was 1-2 something percent. I don't know exactly, but way below 12%. Where does that come from? Where does that hike come from? What's going up in healthcare costs that's not going up anywhere else in the economy? Why?
Yeah. So, you know, what people say is, well, it's technology. You know, you treat an arthritis with a hip replacement rather than an aspirin now. And some of it undoubtedly is that. But a huge portion of it, you know, nothing's changed to be 12% better in the last year in that kind of dramatic way. Instead, the core financial incentive in the system is that because we do not pay teams to deliver the best possible care at the best possible price, we pay teams to we pay individuals in healthcare, every individual separately, for simply delivering more care. And so what we get is quantity of care. It's like building a house. Instead of working with a contractor to say, here's the overall plan, it would be like paying the electrician for every outlet that they put in and every plumber for every pipe they put in, and you get a house with lots of outlets and lots of pipes, but it doesn't necessarily work very well.
You've written about that from a border town in Texas where it looked like positively like a ripoff, like it was a very deliberate, you know, sort of a business plan to drive up the number of everything that's done just to make more money.
That's right. So I was interested in understanding how this happens. I looked at two cities, McAllen, Texas, and El Paso, Texas, both border cities, both very poor. Both very similar health problems. But for Medicare, McAllen, Texas costs twice as much as El Paso. It's, in fact, the second most expensive city in America for Medicare and has been for more than a decade.
Is it still after you ripped the covers off and let the whole country look at what was going on there?
Yep, and the numbers came in for 2007 and it remained well over $16,000 a year for an elderly patient on Medicare compared to $8,000.
So what does that mean? Even when you're held up to sort of national inspection, almost ridicule, almost, the medical system there just goes on charging? Thank you very much.
Well, we won't have the numbers since the article came out for a couple of years, which is another sign of how bad our systems are. We don't even know what's going on in the system for that long. But the second thing is that there is fierce debate even in that town between the leaders who think that there are some very specific things. For example, there are over 200 home health care agencies and a very insidious culture of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, with doctors referring to home health care to the point that over $4,000 per Medicare patient per year is spent on home health care, when in the average community it's less than $400 per patient per year. And they could solve that overnight. A very simple set of checks to make sure that the patients get the right patients are sent to home health care and the others are not. And that has not happened yet because there are millions and millions of dollars that people are making in the current system.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about American healthcare with Dr. Atul Gawande, who has become a big voice in the whole consideration of what comes next, what's going on now, and what we might do better. He's a surgeon, writer, medical thinker. His latest book out in paperback today is The Checklist Manifesto. Surgeon and New Yorker magazine writer both. You may have read his columns there and well beyond. You can join the conversation today. What's your question for Atul Gawande? And how long will we keep debating health care? Can't we just decide, fix it? Have we already done that with last year's big passage of health care reform? Republicans saying no, they're going to vote to repeal next week. That won't be the end of it, but there's a big head of steam on it. Here's incoming House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, Republican of Virginia.
You will see the Republican-led House put a bill across the floor that will call for a full repeal of the Obama health care bill. That will be one of the first things that we will do.
Democrats saying, fine, you give it a try, it won't pass, then we'll talk about it. Here's Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman saying that he welcomes the expected wave of Republican hearings on the issue.
I think a series of hearings would be a good thing because it will educate the Republicans who didn't pay any attention to the bill while it was going through the Congress. And I think the public, the more they hear about this bill, the more they're going to like it.
The more they hear, the more they'll learn. Atul Gawande is with me in the studio. Here's a listener in Santa Cruz, California, Atul, saying, everybody who makes it into med school expects to be a millionaire. And that's the problem.
No, I don't know very many people who are currently in medical school now who expect to be a millionaire because they would be deluded.
but can we have the level of compensation we've had for medical professionals in this country and keep costs under control? Is there a mismatch there?
There's not a mismatch there. One of the strange things is that we underpay the very people who are the most important in the system. If you ask, where are our costs? They come from people ending up in emergency rooms and ending up in hospitals when they don't need to be. And how do you keep people healthy, make sure that they have the right kind of care at the right time? And that is often primary care physicians, primary care nurse practitioners. And
why don't we have more? This listener goes on to say, you know, that there's a conspiracy to keep the product in demand by limiting admissions to schools and maintaining a shortage.
Well, one of the ironies here is that the source of the shortage of primary care physicians is our medical students and doctors ourselves, that we are simply choosing not to go into those fields, partly because they're, you know, a pediatrician is among the lowest paid, or a geriatrician are among the lowest paid physicians there are, and what people want to become are highly remunerative specialties like radiology or highly specialized surgery. I'm a surgeon myself.
Mm-hmm.
And a field that rewards people for doing 15 imaging scans or doing an extra operation, but does not reward for helping people avoid the need for those, is doomed to failure. And that's the source of the high cost, the high technology use, and the warped kinds of incentives and values.
But if we bring down the number of scans, let's say, doesn't that also bring down the medical professional, the doctor's income? I mean, the kind of reform you have in mind, will it end up with doctors, let's say, having the same sort of lifestyle that they have now? Or does it require that they end up, at the end of the day, making less? I mean, where do the savings come from? If it's not the doctor, is it out of insurance company profits? Where is the savings?
The radical change that needs to occur, mm-hmm. and that there are innovations and really fascinating innovations underway in a number of cities around the country, are changes that really shift who wins and who loses. So where there is the cardiologist who, you know, is that people are now starting to investigate, ones who are doing up to 30 catheter insertions in a day,
mm-hmm.
And get rewarded for it, are going to start facing a system where we are all being asked, how successful are we in ensuring that a patient over the course of 5 years has better and better heart health, is able to stay out of the hospital, and reward the physicians who are the very best at helping keep people healthy, which includes engaging patients and being really effective in knowing how to get patients to change behavior?
Are you saying the Obama reforms will bring about this inquiry about the 5-year sort of follow-up, or you're just saying that you're hopeful that
already
it will happen?
Is.
That's baked into this legislation?
It's not. In other words, the legislation does not have a recipe, mm-hmm. but it is a toolbox. It has got a variety of tools, including $10 billion for to fund community innovations that actually demonstrably lower costs without harming a single person, mm-hmm. Investments in creating data that we simply don't have to know how well, you know, for example, we ought to know in our state how many patients had a heart attack, how many had a pneumonia, how many had an operation, and how many died as a result of these things. And we simply don't have the answer to that. And if we do, it's 4 to 5 years old. Starting to ask, now, next year, I not only want to know how many heart attacks, pneumonias, strokes, mm-hmm. and surgical operations and complications there are, but I also want to see that those are declining, reward the healthcare systems that do the better job at it, and punish the ones that don't. That will radically change the practice of medicine. It changes who wins, who loses. Yes, some doctors will make less under that system, and some will make more.
Is that baked into the reforms that are up that are coming up on the rails now, or are you just hoping that that's how it plays out?
So what is baked into the reforms is a substantial amount of money, billions of dollars.
Right, devoted to these inquiries.
To reward,
experiments.
To reward those who devise these kinds of systems. What is not baked in is then taking those and ensuring that they go into place.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very controversial panel that is part of Medicare, the Medicare Advisory Panel, that has been given the power to institute programs like that that work in a local level and put them in across the country and make Congress have an up or down vote. One of the parts of repeal, when the mm-hmm. wholesale repeal doesn't go through, mm-hmm. one of the micro forms of repeal, because the company lobbyists are pushing for it, is to weaken that panel that could ensure that these kinds of lessons can spread across the country.
So here's where the rubber hits the road. I mean, this isn't just the fear of we can't get a handle on this. This is a very specific corporate interest or a conglomeration of corporate interests coming in to fight propagation of cost-saving, more effective treatment patterns.
That's right. I have no question in my mind that over the next few years we're already learning how to effectively provide better care at lower cost. But there are enormous numbers of losers when you do that. It means that hospitals that used to make a lot of money will make less money. It'll mean that we won't need as many hospital beds and that some hospitals would have to close. If these projects become successful, mm-hmm. making sure they go in nationwide mm-hmm. will be fought tooth and nail. And part of the fear I have is that stalemate, repealing mm-hmm. reform, is a signal about who's really going to win here. That when push comes to shove, that it's just going to continue as business as usual. And because everybody can look to Washington and say, we're just stalemated. We're never even going to try anything.
Who's going to drive this through then? I mean, Democrats really didn't. They got their reform package through, but then they didn't really stand up and fight for it because it was seen as politically unpopular last fall. Some did, but many did not. So who's in a position to drive through the changes you're saying are absolutely necessary to get us on a cost and health sustainable path here? Who's going to do that?
So the lesson out of Medicare, 1965, mm-hmm. is there's only one person who can do it. And that's the president. The president is the only one who can go out and continually explain and create the drumbeat of knowledge and understanding of where the country needs to go, not just for healthcare, but as part of making a better economy. And has to, you know, the president doesn't create it. He just creates the atmosphere for that to happen. And one of the concerns I have is about the bringing the administration to be able to make that case to the public and not just in Washington and cutting the deals.
What's the problem with that? They're not listening. They don't know the details. They don't have a point person on it. The president doesn't want to be the point person. I mean, they've paid attention to your work. Where do you see the weakness exactly now in terms of pushing this forward?
So, you know, I don't know exactly what mm-hmm. the story is within the White House. In fighting for reform, there was a huge amount of work that was just the person by person getting your votes in Congress and seeing what deals yep. need to be made. Mm-hmm. And what did not go along with that was bringing to the public some understanding of why, despite the complexity, we're doing this, mm-hmm. what's at stake, and how to understand what's coming through. Because I disagree with Henry Waxman. The more the public hears about this, I don't know that the more they will the more they will love it.
Depends how it comes to them. You mean how it's framed, or
no? I think the more you hear about the details, the more it just seems confusing and complex.
Because there are so many details.
There are so many details, and there is no solution that does not have details mm-hmm. like that. And we need the narrative framework, the story that comes together to help us understand how healthcare fits into the economy as a whole, how the health reform package fits in the economy as a whole, and how being willing to take a step forward and experiment, try and then learn and take mm-hmm. another step mm-hmm. forward is the only way to move forward. There's two reasons you need it. Number one is for the public to come in behind what is going to be a generational effort. You do not mm-hmm. turn 20% of the economy around successfully in 3 years. It's going to take this is part of a process that's going to be what I will be working on for the rest of my career.
Especially if it's fought tooth and nail every step of the way by, you know, vested interests.
There's too much money at stake. It will continue to be fought tooth and nail. And the so this one is bringing the public along on this mission. Mm-hmm. The second is bringing the profession itself along on this mission. You know, that understanding that the way that your local school works is deeply connected to the way your local doctors work mm-hmm. is something that not only the community needs to understand, but we in medicine need to take to heart and be willing to change the way I practice every day what I do.
Let's get a call maybe on that front. Kathleen in Milton, Massachusetts is calling. Hi, Kathleen. You're on the air with Atul Gawande.
Hi, Tom. My question is, well, first a comment. There is the tremendous conflict or tension between cost and the benefit or the quality of health care. How do we measure quality? There's a trick.
Are you in the profession, Kathleen?
Yes, I am. I'm a pediatrician. However, I teach it in a medical school here in Boston.
Okay.
And the question that I have really is, how do we measure quality? It's fairly easy to measure the quality of food, but it's difficult to measure the quality of health care.
So you're a doctor and you're skeptical that simple basic thing can be done?
Yes, yes. I think that a lot of the measurements that are put forth are really proxies for care. For example, the hemoglobin A1C, is that an actual measure of care? To a certain extent, I suppose, but I maintain that it is a proxy for care, and I'm interested in Dr. Gawande's thoughts on this. And I also say, if anybody that has not read his book, go out and get it today to join in the discussion.
Thank you, Kathleen. Our time is short, but there it is, from right out of the profession, skepticism about what's at the heart of your sort of assertion here that we can get to quality care by monitoring quality.
Yeah, it's crucial, because if we're going to pay on the basis of quantity, we can easily measure quantity, and we're going to pay mm-hmm. you know, $1,000 for every operation you do, good or bad.
Off you go.
But how good is your operation? If we are trying to pay on the basis of that individual operation, very, very tough to measure whether, you know, the care was perfect or not perfect. Mm-hmm. But do it at a broad level. This is what we did in our work in surgery. We asked a simple question. How many of the patients died after surgery, and does it go down?
That's okay? This is a good starting question.
This is a basic measure. And at a broad level, if we're making a better healthcare system, it ought to be able to reduce the number of deaths occurring in surgery. We found that by making a simple checklist, 19 steps that include mm-hmm. everything from making sure everyone in the operating room knows each other by name mm-hmm. to having the surgeon brief the team on the goals of the operation, how much time is expected, so everyone's on the same page. Lowered the death rate nearly 50%. It's now been replicated in the Netherlands, in the VA system. They've achieved 20% reduction in mortality.
What about more subtle measures than death?
Well, it's important.
You start
at the basics, though, because we're not even close to doing that.
Okay.
You know, we're not even asking, is our healthcare system better today than it was 2 years ago or 5 years ago? We're simply not asking. We're not asking whether we have fewer heart attacks, fewer pneumonias, fewer surgeries, and further, whether when you have a heart attack, pneumonia, or an operation, mm-hmm. whether you do better than you used to. And I think we can begin to ask those very basic questions as the starting point. But there's no question there's more sophistication we want underneath that. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to say, are we reducing people's how many times they end up in a hospital in a year? Are they having better service? Are they having better and when we talk about quality, if we have to get down to the nuts and bolts of is this patient X getting better quality than they did 2 years ago? It is very hard, but we know ways to ask at a broad level. Take 100,000 people, and are they less likely to get the ravages of disease that people face when they get those diseases, as we all eventually mm-hmm, do? Mm-hmm. Do they do better than they otherwise would? And are we wasting? Are we using fewer resources in getting those improvements over time?
So it's a step-by-step thing. You're saying sort of knit the practice and measurement toward each other until you've got a better system.
That's right. And that's why I say it's a generational process. Mm-hmm. We have now found in surgery how to do this in ways that we can help individual hospitals improve remarkably, get markedly better results and monitor what they're doing. We've now learned how to do it in reducing infections. We're going to learn how to do it in improving quality of life for patients facing terminal illness.
We've got half a minute. Are you confident we'll do it overall in this country? Are you confident we will make this generational change?
No, we're in the midst of a struggle now for the soul of medicine. It is whether we believe that we are capable of making a better system or not and trying to take this next step, or we believe that medicine will simply always be just about business and how much money people can make off of it. And that is core.
And the stakes in that contest?
Our stakes are not only whether people are healthy or not. It's the function of our economy. The deepest threat to our economy over this next generation is whether healthcare costs will mean we have no money left for the education of our children, investment in new kinds of industry, innovations in energy and other arenas. So that's why my eyes are on this ball, why I find it completely fascinating, and why it's morally, I think, central.
There's a lot to keep in mind in the debate that will unfold in just the weeks ahead. Dr. Atul Gawande, author of The Checklist Manifesto and much more, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.